Welcome, welcome. It's The Bleak Outlook with your hosts, Siobhan and Andrew. Let's talk about our new music. This is an original score by Taylor Goodson, a percussionist and just a musician extraordinaire who was excellent to work with. Public service announcement, please pay your artists a fair fee and support living artists.
Yes, and as many artists will tell you, they cannot afford to pay for things with exposure. Despite how amazing your project might be, and you're telling them, oh yeah, we're going to build together, it's going to be great exposure for you, go to your landlord and tell them, hey, I don't have the rent this month, but I got this exposure for the building, though.
People die of exposure.
Yeah, see how they react when they do that. So shout out to Taylor and artists everywhere who can make a living because people pay them for the art that they create.
And just be honest with yourself. It ain't that much money. You could do it. It's like slipping those coins. They deserve it. They're talented. And every piece that you receive from an artist is not just a one-off. You know, they're playing around on the keyboard or playing around on a sketch pad. This is years of work, years of toiling, doubting themselves and freely coming into their craft. So what you're getting is several years of experience on one page.
On this episode of The Bleak Outlook, some guided meditation.
You're in a room with a rich orange accent wall and black curtains. The sun has already come in, sparkling golden yellow beams through a crack in the curtains. The wood floors are slightly covered by t-shirts, jeans, and underwear that may or may not be dirty. It's slightly a mess. You wake up at 9 a.m. on a Saturday. You've just gone through a breakup and awaken again with the guilt of being to blame. You screwed up, and she's already moved on. The depression is bad today. Feels like you're swimming through oil and your head is weighed down by 1,000 mistakes. But you get up and trudge to the kitchen. You make yourself a spinach omelet with red bell peppers and a slice of whole wheat toast. You're trying to eat healthier. Perhaps a tall glass of water today. Coffee makes you agitated and worsens your anxiety. You step out into a warm, sunny mid-morning and catch the bus downtown. Your headphones are on and you're listening to a new album. It's soothing and you're deep in thought. Your brow is furrowed as you bob your head. An old woman does not sit in the seat next to you, even though you scoot over. You dismiss it. Whatever. You walk into a sports store and cool air blows on you. It's as comforting as the song you're listening to. What's even worse than crowds is open space. The focus is on you and you've been battling against that anxious feeling. It's early and the store is relatively empty, but you already feel eyes on you. You dismiss it. Whatever. There are new sneakers out and they're in bold colors. You're unsure. Would they suit you? You feel eyes on you, and again, an attendant busies himself in your vicinity. It's distracting. It's annoying. The young man of about 25 says nothing. Just a shy smile. You don't smile back. This again. You watch a woman, nearby, place a pair of earrings in her purse. Then a bracelet. Her child is on her hip. You shake your head. The attendant doesn't notice. Maybe he does and doesn't care. Either way, his eyes are still glancing in your direction. You don't smile back. This is bullshit. As you leave, you hear a feeble, "Have a good day," from the checkout girl. You manage to grumble, "Yeah, thanks." You don't mean it, and she knows. You don't smile back. This is bullshit. You shake it off and head into a convenience store. You're parched and are trying to drink more water, but you're indecisive and wonder if the fruit juice has too much sugar. Just then, there's a presence behind you. "Sorry about that." "No problem." "Yeah, fruit juice definitely has too much sugar." A cop comes in and your eyes lock. You quickly turn away, and all of a sudden the room gets warmer. Oh boy. You get your bottle of water and bring it to the counter. You've done nothing. You've said little. Don't panic. You've done nothing. The store clerk is cold and dryly tells you your total. His eyes glance behind you. The cop is there, and he is close. Too close. It makes you nervous. It makes you anxious. You've done nothing. You've said little. Play it cool. Just go. Just go. You start to leave when the cop touches your shoulder and you flinch. You shrug his hand off and your eyes lock in surprise and fear. The cop reacts. Just like that, his hand is on his holster and you're sweating. You see the metal glimmer. You look at him in the eyes, then at the gun. Take it easy, man. You forgot your change. You grab it and swiftly head out. You're close to a panic attack this time. Your heart is pounding and you're angry. There's nowhere to put this feeling, so you swallow it deep inside. You bury it. Until next time. Perspective. One of the stories that made an impression on me in high school was The Summoning of Every Man. It's a moral story that's an allegory. It's basic and very relatable. Every man gets approached by death and he's made to make an account for his life. And every man is very worried because he doesn't know who he's going to take on this journey to the grave. And he enlists the help of many friends, among them beauty, wealth, fellowship. But in the end, when he meets the grave, the only one that's left is good works, good deeds. And it's an interesting story because it's sort of a blank slate and you can kind of insert different parts and different facets to that very basic story to say, well, when a man or any woman goes through a journey of life and meets all these friends, in quotes, to help them through life, you know, what is going to be the most dependable? In the story in particular, he finds out that wealth is a swindler. And then, in fact, wealth admits it openly that, you know, he's to go to no grave with no man, and he's here for fun. I just think that's a really interesting thing to consider the story of the summoning of every man. And I would love to see more stories that are centered on Black people and their experience so that we can see ourselves as every man, that we can have that default story. So for me, that's what I love is seeing stories like that is when a Black man is every man.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me how you just frame it as, you know, that story is about good is the only thing that's left. But then my question is, like, what is good? Because I was watching the TV show The Good Place, and spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't gotten to season 3 yet, but there's a question, there becomes a point in the show where they start to say, well, this guy does everything good, you know, he's kind, he is kind to animals, he cares about the environment, he treats people well. And then they realize he's not getting into the good place because every action he takes is actually a negative. Because when he's kind to someone else and he gets some flowers, it's like, well, you're contributing to the death of the environment because those flowers had to be picked in Florida and then shipped to Ohio. And when he's like, doesn't kill the animals, he's like, well, you're letting animals roam free and then they kill other animals. And every action that you do, no matter how good or how well-intentioned, ends up not being good. So I'm saying, well, if this guy can't get in, who can get in?
I never really thought of it that way. But what's interesting is that if you are looking at a story, let's say an everyman story, and we're convinced that certain actions that people do are good, what happens when we see that story from the other side? Because we're always very convinced that people are taking like the righteous action, when in fact they have an impact on wherever they go. And it brings to mind like something I saw on, it was like MTV's like Road Rules or something. And they had gone to, India or like Bangladesh or some country in that region. And one of the cast members like was handing out like lollipops to these kids. And she was so proud of herself and saying like, you know, I've given these kids such a treat, and it's such a joy that they should have this. And, you know, other people were kind of commenting on the fact that she's very tone deaf. And, you know, we often see that of a savior who comes and who brings joy and light to, you know, whatever village that they visit. But really, like, let's think of it in a practical sense. These children maybe don't have consistent dental care, and maybe they don't have a consistent diet. And so you giving them candy is actually like pretty offensive, right? You're contributing to their poor dental health. You're probably overriding what their parents want them to do. Maybe their parents don't want them eating that stuff. And, you know, it's just kind of like you leave your trash here. You come here and you want to have this experience, and it changes you. And in the traditional sense of storytelling, we leave with that character. Oh, it feels so good coming to this place and seeing this culture. But what happens when we explore the other side of that story and we say, like, what gets left behind? First of all, it's your trash from your blow pops, which are going to be in the landfill for 1,000 years. But there's also, you know, what if we're looking past those children and seeing somebody who's in, let's say, a store nearby who's smoking and knows that, like, when he was a young kid and there were people coming to his country to bring treats, that these treats were like tobacco, these mm-hmm. treats were opium. And so now this person is very, very old and thinking to himself, you know, I am dying from this treat yep. that they brought me, this tobacco that I can't put down. And now this woman now is bringing, yeah. this woman is bringing diabetes to my
exactly
kids.
That's exactly what I was going
to
say.
Yeah.
In 22 years,
yeah.
those kids are going to be the man standing in the store, struggling to get their insulin pens.
Exactly.
And then looking at the next wave of people from outside of the country coming in as these saviors or these deliverers of these great experiences.
Yeah.
And we're all the hero in our own story, at least in mm-hmm. our minds.
Mm-hmm.
And the people on that show and the people in general just don't realize how they're not seeing anything from the perspective of the people that they're going into, whose homes, whose native lands that they're going into.
Mm.
Everyone gets upset when they see the fashion shoots where they go into these markets or they go into rural areas of Africa and Southeast Asia. And, you know, they have they treat the people there as background, their props, essentially. And they're like, oh, look, we're exposing them to high fashion, and we're giving them we're inspiring them with these models here and showcasing them to the world with this great art. And they're like, hold on now, we have art here, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we wear our art, like our clothes themselves, the clothes,
exactly.
The choices we make in our clothing are representative of like centuries of culture. Mm-hmm. Like you look at the Maori and a lot of people in mm-hmm. Polynesia,
yeah.
their skin is literally art, and it's communication of things. Like those aren't just tattoos. They're
yes.
things that they
yes.
willfully did, and they did it by perspective. So now the weird thing is in sports, I see this a lot of times with people who aren't familiar with the haka, which is like the chant
yes.
that a lot of Polynesian people mm-hmm. do before matches. They say like, oh, this is unsportsmanlike. This is not what the
this
game
is
about.
Uncalled for. Let's keep this
yeah.
down, right?
And what they don't realize is that the haka is actually, you're giving honor to the person mm-hmm. that you're about to compete with.
Yes.
Like it's something that they do at funerals and memorials mm-hmm. in a lot of places in New Zealand and Australia and Micronesia. And it's like, how do you interpret this as a violent act in sports? Is because you're viewing it through your perspective of course. A Western person, and this is outside of the decorum of what we expect from our athletes. And then they're like, for us not to do the haka would be offensive to you.
Exactly.
Like we're trying to honor
you.
We're
bigging you up. We're yeah. gassing you up. Like, take this. And interesting is when you see these high fashion pictures, zoom in on the people in the background. They are not here for it. Their faces are just like, no. who are you?
Yeah,
whose man's is this?
Whose man's is this? He's like, look, y'all either gonna buy an orange or get the hell out.
Seriously.
This fruit stand, I know it's got great colors and it looks great when the sunlight reflects and your camera picks it up. But guess what? My kids got to eat. And
exactly.
I don't want to feed them lollipops that you people are bringing around. So I need to sell some oranges. Are you buying an orange or not?
This is the beginning and end of the story. And as to us wearing art, it's so interesting to me, like, the things that are considered professional and professional in a particular setting. And as much as we like to keep people's culture in a globe, right? Oh, this is so beautiful. This is so colorful. You would never allow that in your office. You would never allow people to wear, like a Nigerian woman, like let's say she wears her gele, like her head wrap. You would never wear that to a meeting. People would tell you it was distracting or it was, I think we should save that for other types of gatherings, wink, wink. So there's that part of the story where our culture, our colorfulness, everything that makes us who we are, our tattoos, whether they're on our face or on our hands or the way that we shave our heads in different designs, those are all like fun stuff. And they're not to be migrated into like the mainstream. I just think that's this is why, you know, just going back to like one part in Black Panther where they're at basically a council meeting and they have all these people who are from these tribes, the Maasai, and I forget what they're called, but they have the lip plates. This man is in a three-piece suit, and he still is wearing his lip plate.
Yeah.
This woman is a Maasai, and she has a gown on, and her skin still has ochre on it. Her hair is still coated in ochre. So all of those things are migrated into the present society, and it seems like when we're telling these stories that are the ones that we're used to right now, all of that culture is in a box. It's in a globe for us to admire and to pick at, but never ever to treat as legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that in the way that rules get written. Mohawks are not allowed in school. We know that. Afros are not allowed in school. And I remember just one day, it was just a realization like, hold on a second. An Afro is basically the equivalent of my hair being down for people with, you know, straighter hair. An Afro is a natural condition to my hair. How is it that I'm not allowed to wear my Afro? That the absurdity of it reaches you and you're just like, huh, they're outlawing my natural state.
Because you're not allowed to exist. And that is a willful and deliberate policy.
Oh my God.
They're not just doing it and say like, oh, we don't want to accommodate her style choices. No, like, we don't want to accommodate who she is. We want her to conform into the dominant culture, into the dominant perspective, and she needs to act the way that we deem appropriate.
Mm.
And that's at the center of like all those decisions they make.
That's, when you say it like that, it's very frightening. It is actually frightening. Because when we talk about even cultural appropriation, right? If I lock my hair, you know, and people want to always make this argument, like, there's people around the world who lock their hair. It's not a Black thing. It's, hold on a second. People have been fired for wearing locks. Mm-hmm. So when you wear your locks and act like it's just sort of a fashion statement and you're in a position to basically be like sort of free-spirited and do that, that's how people take it. But when I have my locks and I'm entering a courtroom and people are looking at me like, yeah, I don't know about those locks. That's a totally different game that we're playing here.
I'll never forget when I was in the 10th grade, my school had a policy that you were not allowed to have cornrows. Or they said, I forgot what the exact phrase they used, but it was like distractive hair locking designs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I'm like, okay. And then my white teacher went to Jamaica. She went to Turks and Caicos.
Got her vacation braids.
Yeah. She came back with the Bo Derek braids. And beads and everything. It was like, oh my God.
That is so beautiful.
Miss XYZ, that looks so cute on you.
It's full on.
And she's
braids,
walking around.
But whatever, sure.
With braids. Meanwhile, if a guy that was had, he had like Iverson design style braids. Like weren't cornrows because they didn't go straight back. But like he had that where it was like, it was weaving in and out and it was like a pattern to it.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, you got to go down to the CSI. I mean, to the in-school suspension, because that's not appropriate. You're violating the dress code. And I'm like, this is a design that has been around forever.
Mm-hmm.
This is a hairstyle that has been around forever. And the alternative is for him to walk around with his quote-unquote wild afro. But because it's assigned to him and his dark skin, you're deeming that inappropriate. But this white woman whose hair is not designed for this texture or this style at all, is allowed to walk around and be praised for it.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'd never understood the disconnect between them. I was like, why is she allowed to walk around like that, but the people who look like us aren't?
It's the aspect of keeping people's culture and keeping their story in a globe as something that we can observe, something that we can experience maybe, and then come out of, right? Because she doesn't have to wear her hair in vacation braids. There are some people where this is dyed in the wool, like part of their culture, part of who they are. This is part of protective style and keeping my hair, neat and manageable from day to day is keeping it in braids. I kind of like have to wear my hair in braids. So for, in that respect, it's like, when someone's culture is fun, when their story is just a background, you know, like props, you don't have to treat them like they're humans. You don't have to treat them like their story is universal. You treat it like it's a curiosity. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of having more Black stories out there, to be able to look at the other side and say, like, you know, what is it like for a young Black male who decides to grow his hair out? You know, what if there are sort of insecurities about the way he wears his hair, or him learning how to take care of his hair? You know, we have a natural hair movement right now, which, I mean, obviously is now in a mainstream. You know, think about what about the aspect of sort of homophobia and thinking that if he wears a twist out, like, what are his boys going to think about his twist out? You know, is it acceptable? So I would love for us to tell different stories, take a traditional story and take a spin on it. Like that Jordan Peele shit, because my God, he's a genius, absolute genius. And I would love to take those traditional stories we're used to and see the other side of it, because I think a lot of times people want to feel good after a story's told, but really, like, ain't no good to this story. Yeah. There's nothing good to it.
And that's kind of the cool thing about like some of Jordan Peele's work, because like obviously Get Out, it's race is central to the story. That is a movie about central. But when you look at something like Us, that's just a horror movie starring a family that happens to be Black. There's some small elements of it that, like, yeah, you can consider race, but you could easily have swapped in an Asian family, a Latino family, or the white family that they're friends with. They could have been the stars. But the difference was he just made a movie that was interesting to him, and he used people that looked like him. And I remember seeing a bunch of people getting upset about it, because they're saying, he said, I'm not going to make a movie with a random white guy as the star of the movie. I've seen that movie already.
Yeah.
I'm just going to make a movie and I'm just going to choose people who look like me. And then I'm going to tie in how that tiny little difference, cultural, racial, gender, religion, whatever it may be, how that makes a small tweak to the story, but it's still universal. It's still, I'm looking at you and I'm seeing someone who doesn't look like me, but I can relate to the fear and the craziness that I would feel if my family was in the situation.
Another interesting part of that is when you see people's fear, when you see their anxiety, when you feel it, when you're part of their internal monologue, which is kind of what that meditation was, is to be able for you to kind of see inside someone's internal monologue. You start to be able to read people better. Right, because you know that when you get upset, especially if you're in the office, people read that as just blind anger. They don't read it as passion. They don't read it as frustration. They don't read it as like a multifaceted thing. They read it as like a single emotion, and so they react to it as a single emotion and try to like quell you when that's not really what you're saying. So I think actually having Black faces on horror films, on romantic films, helps you read people of a different culture like better, which it helps us understand people better.
Yeah, and I think that's why it's so critical that in the story of every man, when we're thinking about it, or we're just thinking about, matter of fact, let's focus on the meditation story you just said. A lot of people, when they see, if they saw like a white guy in that situation, they'd say like, oh, some angsty teen, he's probably listening to rock music on his headphones, he's just minding his business. If someone saw me in that same situation, me being a 6'1", heavyset Black guy with a thick beard, you know, approaching Rick Ross levels at this point. Matter of fact, I need to go to the barbershop after I leave here.
I mean, honestly, like, you had that Rick Ross thing going for a while. Like, I was on board with it. I just want to tell you that I support all beards.
Okay. Thank you.
That out there.
But, like, someone might see that and say, like, oh, that's kind of a scary dude.
Yeah.
They don't know that in my podcast. I mean, I'm listening to podcasts in my headphones, or I'm listening to Les Mis, or I'm listening to, like, Disney soundtracks.
Yeah.
Because, and then they just think, like, oh, this is a big, scary dude. Like, they're not even seeing that, like, hey, man, you love I Dreamed a Dream. Me too. That's, like, what a great song. That's what
exactly.
I'm listening to. Like, I'm just nervous because I'm around a police officer.
And yeah.
Historically speaking, that a lot of shit goes down when yeah. you're near a police officer, even when you're not doing anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how quickly could he see me reaching for my telephone? Which, on second thought, I kind of regret it. I picked one that's kind of metallic, and I have this case that's with a black rim. He could easily misinterpret that as a gun as I'm pulling it out of my pocket. And next thing you know, I'm on Channel 11 News, and that's a nervous thought that stays with me sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's because police officers or whoever have been trained to see me as a potential threat. They don't see me as the guy they went to high school with.
Interesting thing about Black Lives Matter is that if you want to, people, they kind of, they want to change like the scope and the narrative of it and say that it's sort of black nationalist. But for me, the very thin line that you can attach yourself to is what Black Lives Matter is saying is preserve my life. Mm-hmm. Don't kill me. That's what that's saying.
Yeah.
And
you would think that'd be a reasonable demand. Like, hey, just don't shoot me.
Could we not? Can we talk? Because they'll talk somebody off a ledge for 3 hours. But they'll say, oh, well, I mean, I know that he was 12, but he could have shot me. Mm-hmm. And you're like, what aim does a 12-year-old, he's a marksman.
He looked like a man. Meanwhile, a guy got arrested today. He was wearing a bulletproof vest, had visibly was holding like a big semi-automatic rifle, and he got arrested.
It's like arrested, not murdered. Yes. Just arrested.
Just a average looking white man, and then they said he was having an emotional episode when they arrested him. And I was like, we can accommodate these people who are clearly displaying
patently,
yeah, like they're actively being violent or showing intention to be violent with you. Why do we have the patience for them, but we don't have it for a 12-year-old in a park who's playing with a toy gun?
Yeah.
And he is murdered within
seconds, like,
of your arrival.
Car didn't even stop.
Or someone who's in a store, in a Walmart, and he's told, put the gun down. And he literally just looks at the person and says, it's a toy, and it's in the store, it's on the shelf. And before he can finish the sentence, there's a bullet riddling through him.
Yeah. And When you see more black stories, you start to say, like, hold on a second. You get to know people and you start to sort of think of them as, I don't know, it's weird to try to convince people to see your humanity. Like, you know, let's say if you see Andrew on the street and you say, oh, this scary black dude, you don't know him. You don't know him. And if I tell you about, who Andrew is as a person, you'd be like, oh, my God. You know, I value him in a way that, you know, he's my brother. And so for you to come into a story and paint him as one thing, that's, for me, the absurdity and the offensiveness of it is astounding. And so all these men who and women who we don't treat as every man, who we don't attribute, like, take a second to tell a different narrative about, we see them as one thing. We see them as not multifaceted, as not complicated, as not making bad decisions. Sometimes people make bad decisions on that day or on that week, or maybe they made bad decisions in their life. But that doesn't make them any less worthy of our compassion or our patience. I think it's important to kind of start having that conversation of why we don't see people in that way. And that's a very uncomfortable conversation because I don't think people can tell you why they're suspicious or why they don't give the benefit of the doubt. And just going back to the topic of seeing more people, black people, brown people in Universal stories, showing their journey, showing the parts of them that, that are essential to the story, their culture, who they are, their tattoos, their colorful clothes and things, and being able to read them. I know that for me, my passion has been misconstrued as anger. And I'm sure Andrew has had that that unfortunate, result as well.
Hey, buddy, this email sounds kind of aggressive. You're like, I literally just said, yep, I'm on it. And then I was called into an office like, hey, man, this email, you got to tone it down. You know, you sound kind of angry in this one.
I mean, when you're able, I think when we have this, when we stop having sort of like white guys in the story and we start having black women and brown women and black men and trans people and everyone being able to tell a story and for us to kind of attach ourselves to it, we start reading emotions and attributing value to people in ways that, that we haven't. And we become a more cohesive society because we're able to not just see that blind anger that we're sort of used to the story being told. We see people's frustrations. We see their despair. We see their insecurity. I'm vulnerable too. I'm a very vulnerable person. I, you know, crack jokes as a defense mechanism, as my therapist will tell you, but I hurt too. And I think seeing that hurt and seeing that pain and having a bigger volume of all these stories really helps everyone. It helps black people to even see themselves as more multifaceted when sometimes, you know, you're seeing yourself through the eyes of somebody who doesn't value you or doesn't see you the way that you want to be seen. So it's important.
And with that, I think it's a good place for us to wrap up this episode of The Bleak Outlook, hosted by Siobhan and Andrew. Just want to thank everyone who tuned in and took the time to listen to our perspective. And we want to use this moment to encourage you to do the same for someone else around you. You know, walk inside someone else's mind. We often tell people to walk inside someone else's shoes. When you do that, you only see what they're going through. But when you walk inside someone's mind, you see their perspective and see how they interpret or feel or respond to the situation that they're facing. And if you, no matter what you are, if you're a cis hetero male, if you're someone who's just dismissive of some of the people in your life, you're unaware of what they might be experiencing or how they might be living their daily life, and you're assigning something to them, think of how they're responding and how they feel. This is once again Andrew and Siobhan with The Bleak Outlook. Thank you all for listening. Be sure to subscribe, tell a friend to subscribe, and tell that friend to tell a friend. Follow us on social media. And until next time, see you guys again.
Bye.